Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop, from the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:01 a.m. Coming up on APA Compass, they present an audio postcard from the Congressional Gold Medal Tribute. At 10, hear Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, we look at Mexico, where the teachers continue their struggle for better working conditions and a living wage. At 11 on It Takes a Village, host Shahid Hamid hosts a show called Confessions of a Reformed Gangbanger, The Turnaround. And at 11 on the radio, at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Paula Small speaks with members of the local African American Health Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting and improving health and wellness in Oregon's Black and African American community and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support, and thanks for listening to your progressive talk radio community radio station. Stay tuned. APA Compass is up next. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Japanese Garden, celebrating its 50th anniversary with the Wakakoro Brothers, with Masahiro Nitta, the three-stringed samurai, on the shamisen Wednesday, October 16th at the Portland Art Museum's Grand Ballroom. Tickets and information at pam.spotlightboxoffice.com.
Good morning. You're listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. APA Compass airs the first Friday of each month at 9 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. On today's Heart to Heart, Ka shares her thoughts on leaders and leadership. Also, Vivek Balb, author of Bengali Harlem, traces the lives of South Asian silk merchants who came to the U.S. to settle in the early 1900s. But first, we feature several stories from Japanese-American World War II vets and camp internees who recently came together in Portland to celebrate the veterans' Congressional Gold Medal.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
General George Marshall was asked early in World War II if America had a secret weapon that would ensure victory in the war. And Marshall responded by saying, yes, America does have a secret weapon. It's the best darn kids in the world. We gather today to remember and pay tribute to some of those best darn kids. Remarkable and courageous heroes who were members of the 100th Infantry Battalion, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and the Military Intelligence Service. These best darn kids were willing to fight and die for their country, despite the fact that their country and many of their countrymen did not treat them with justice, fairness, or respect.
And to the Republic for which it stands.
These men fought for the freedom of others while their own rights and those of their families were being denied. They served this country as it held their own family and friends. Such is their remarkable example of dedication, unwavering loyalty, and patriotism beyond compare.
One nation, under God, indivisible.
The Congressional Gold Medal, which if you have not already seen it, absolutely take advantage of this day to do so, is the highest civilian honor. But in keeping with the humility for which the Nisei are so well known, it fits into the palm of one's hand. Notwithstanding its small size, it carries a history of enormous consequence. It represents the very essence of freedom in America, and it is a touchstone to service and sacrifice and loyalty and courage and honor and patriotism that exemplifies the Nisei contributions to this nation.
A few friends were asking me about the day, and I told them that the Go for Broke regiment was finally going to be recognized. And one of them said, it's about time. And I think we all understand that's not quite right. It's not just about time. It is way, way, way past time. And let us make sure that this community understands how much we appreciate these courageous soldiers today.
You heard the voices of Kerry Timchuk, Lynn Fujigami Longfellow, Anna Cohn, and Senator Ron Wyden at a celebration in Portland, Oregon with local Japanese-American Nisei soldiers who served in World War II and who were collectively awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. These American soldiers of Japanese descent fought with high distinction and record-setting decoration counts. Ironically, many of the soldiers' families were placed in internment camps during World War II in an act of government racism justified by war hysteria. Unfortunately, the racism persisted after the end of the war, with many Nikkei families unable to reclaim their property and reestablish themselves in their former neighborhoods. In an attempt to right the wrongs of the past, the government apologized and paid nominal reparations 40 years after the war, and awarded the Congressional Gold Medal 60 years later. I had the pleasure of speaking with several of the veterans. First, we have Shig Imai, and Mark Namba, who are neighbors in the former company town of D in Hood River County, Oregon. Shig tells of guarding prisoners of war in Honolulu in 1944 and 1945. He also talks about the reception he and other Japanese Americans received when they returned home from service.
You're both from Hood River, right?
In fact, we were formerly living a place called D, and he and I were neighbors. We had an orchard. And we were only half a mile apart. D itself, is city, is gone because we used to have a lumber mill and it closed down, and so the only farm is left up on a hill.
What was your role in World War II?
I had a real easy situation because I didn't graduate from MI school itself, so they put us in a AMP unit. And we were sent over to Hawaii, 1944 and 45. And I was in a unit, MP unit, that took care of prisoner of war camp in Honolulu called Hanauliuli. But previous to that, some of the Hawaiians and Italians and people that were FBI rounded up were using that as a detention center. But last 2 years, they had as a prisoner of war camp, and what they had was not Japanese itself. It was about 300 young Koreans that were captured because they were used as a support for the Japanese soldiers. We were the unit that guarded them, and we were kind of a go-between if we have to talk to them. And those days, Koreans were able to talk Japanese, so they understood us. So we had no problem. We were classified as an interpreter, but we were mostly pulling guard duty. But our company that I was in was called 162nd Prisoner of War Processing Company. And that company was designed to make personnel record of the prisoner of war. But they never did it. We never did the job like we were supposed to do. We were just guards.
How were you treated when you were part of the military as a...
Oh, we were okay.
Okay.
When I first went in the service, we were sent to a place called Camp Grand Illinois, and that was a training center for medical administrative corps. So we took our basic there. Then they didn't know where to send us, so they put us over at the camp's station hospital. And we were all the Niseis were gathered up and put over there at the station hospital to do all the work to wherever there was. Ward boy, truck driver, cook, you know, they were just told to do whatever it was due. I was just assigned to the office work.
I see. So after you returned, after the war, you came back to Hood River. What was your reception then?
Things had changed, right?
Yeah,
it was kind of rough. But we managed because we owned a property out in the country, and we didn't have to deal with the people in town, so we survived running our farm. So we were too busy trying to fight them, but yeah, it was pretty rough during the war. American Legion at that time was real bad, but during the war.
Right.
But since I joined the Legion, I guess around 1950, we were accepted as a member of American Legion.
If you'd like to learn more about the gruff reception which he and other Japanese Americans encountered returning home after World War II, I recommend the excellent book, Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence, Coming Home to Hood River by Linda Tamura. I also spoke with Roy Matsumoto, who served as a Japanese language intelligence specialist with Merrill's Marauders in the Burma campaign. Merrill's Marauders became famous for their deep penetration missions behind Japanese lines, frequently facing Japanese forces greater than their own. Matsumoto was essential to the Marauders' success. While his battalion was trapped in Napumga, Matsumoto crawled away every night to the Japanese lines to overhear their plans and played a critical role in the subsequent battle. He tells us what happened.
What did you serve in during World War II?
In Burma. It was the Merrill's Marauders.
And what was your role there?
I went to language school and graduated, assigned to General Stilwell's army, and General Merrill invaded Burma, and I accompanied them.
So you were a translator then?
Yes, translator, interrogator, investigator. All kind of intelligence work.
So I understand it was difficult being a Japanese-American serving in the Pacific Theater.
Right.
Because there was always worries that you'd be mistaken.
Yeah, sure, that's right. They're the danger. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then pretty hard to tell from Vietnamese or natives and Japanese and Chinese. See? All mixed up there. So, of course, we're being protected, but pretty dangerous situation.
Do you have any favorite memories from that time?
Well, what happened was a place called Wallabomb, and we encountered enemy communication line, and I tapped in, and they got the information what their plan were.
I see that.
So we were able to survive ourselves, and also after that, we know what their plan were. Then a place called Napunga, we've been surrounded for 10 days, no place to go, but I risked my life to find out what the enemy plan was. And one night, I find out the enemy going to attack following dawn attack. So we came back and we evacuated foxhole and booby trap and set up another fire line and waited. Sure enough, they came and they attacked the foxhole and bayonet and everything. We weren't there. So they thought maybe we're up there. Then we waited up a little up above. Then they came to about 15 yards. We opened up, commenced fire. Then went more than down. Then reinforcement, the troops coming up there. And they saw the commotion there, just like a Chinese, New Year. So all get excited. They heard that the first group would be wiped out. So they tried to retreat. I gave them order to attack order. I gave my Japanese order, said, "Totsuki ne." You know, Tokan, Tsukane. They thought I was a Japanese officer in charge. So follow my order and go up there and open up again. Then about 30 minutes after daybreak, we found the 54 dead ones, no wounded ones, no prisoners. And outside, nobody got to scratch. 54, enemy dead. Received a Legion of Merit for saving a 2 battalion, and nobody got hurt, and I myself survived. I'm still here, and I'm 3 months older than 100 years, so I'm greatly honored.
Thank you for
For his heroics, Matsumoto earned the Bronze Star, the Legion of Merit, and of course the Congressional Gold Medal. He was inducted into the Ranger Hall of Fame and the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame, and has the distinction of being the only person inducted into two halls of fame. More details about Matsumoto and his amazing story can be found in the documentary, Honor and Sacrifice, The Roy Matsumoto Story. Many thanks to the Oregon Nikkei Endowment, the Oregon Historical Society, and the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Service for bringing the Congressional Gold Medal and these Japanese-American veterans together in Portland. Thanks to Shig Imai and Roy Matsumoto for sharing their stories with us. Nola Bogle sang the Star-Spangled Banner. I'm Andrew Yeh for APA Compass.
In 2013, 72 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor and subsequent illegal internment of Japanese Americans through Executive Order 9066, a new documentary called Searchlight Serenade was released on tour in the United States. In Portland, the screening was held at the Portland Hilton on August 24th. That evening, music accompanied the film as the Minidoka Swing Band played for the audience. Besides the entertainment provided that evening, the historical value of the documentary attracted those who were interested in learning more about the camps and the role of the music there. The documentary was a mix of interviews of former musicians and historical narratives tracing the events following the attack on Pearl Harbor. These memories of camp life reveal resilience and a drive to restore a sense of normalcy as camp internees coped with their political and legal circumstances. Evacuation from the West Coast meant loss of property, business and community connections, along with being stripped of American citizenship. Japanese Americans were able to ground themselves through the experience of their treatment at the hands of the United States government, and one such coping mechanism in camp life drew largely from music. Big band music of the time followed Japanese American internees from the mainstream United States into the internment camps and receded behind barbed wire fences. Known for its energetic upswing beats and boisterous instrumental solos, big band sounds would allow camp residents a slight distancing from the war. The music also reinforced the identity that many camp internees themselves had always asserted, that they were American, not just politically, but culturally and socially as well. From those perspectives, the film examined how those events changed the camp bands even after they had become crucial to their audiences. After detention in camp life marked a group of people as alien in America, continuing government regulation even after the war had ended furthered the image of Japanese American citizens as foreign residents rather than United States citizens. Before the screening, I was able to sit down with artist animator Amy Uyeki of Arcata, California, to talk about the making of the film. Searchlight Serenade also includes scenes of animation which she first created as woodcut artwork, then animated to depict aspects of camp life. How did you first get the idea to make this film?
This project developed actually a long time ago. It had seeds in a project that my daughter did, who is now 23, but when she was in her freshman year of high school, she did an iMovie project that was based on the Nisei who were interned in the Japanese-American incarceration camps. And her grandparents, my parents, were interned in two different camps. So she wanted to explore that whole history, which she wasn't very aware of. And she did such a great job. I actually learned some things. And I thought I hadn't known everything. Not everything, that's a conceit there. But I'd known a lot about the history from my parents and also from reading a lot about it. But I didn't really know about the big bands that were so much a part of the lives of the Nisei, the second generation Japanese Americans who were in the camps. And her documentary just mentioned the different clubs that were formed in the camps that really made a difference in terms of, you could say, a distraction, but also bringing some pleasure and community and an escape from the drudgery and the boredom and the frustration of being incarcerated, for especially the Nisei. And one of those diversions were the big bands. And so that was sort of the start, and I heard about all the big bands in the different camps, and then I talked to a friend who said, do you know George Yoshida? And I said, no. And she said, well, I think he wrote a book about Japanese-American music. So I Googled him. I got his book, and he had this fantastic chapter in his book. The book is called Reminiscing in Swing Time. It's Japanese-American popular music from 1925 to 1960 or something like that. And there was a chapter about the incarceration of the Japanese nationals and Japanese Americans on the West Coast.
Could you talk about the animated scenes in the documentary?
I think it takes about 12 minutes in the documentary, but the animation itself takes about 15 minutes from start to finish, and that's in its entirety. And my idea was that there are several reasons why I did this, but I wanted the whole story to be told in song and no narration, no words, or except for the lyrics in the songs. And part of that was I didn't know how to, you know, script a story and actually have actors act it out. And would they, you know, would they talk with accents? Would they use Japanese? What kind of Japanese would they use? And, you know, it just was made it much more complicated. So I thought, well, I'm going to just see if I can have the story told in song. So I pulled, I was able to find songs from the era that described what was going on, or they were counterpoint to what was going on. For instance, there's a song that sung by Bing Crosby, and it's about, you know, how great it is to live in the USA, and it's real cheery music, and so I have that that is being sung while the scenes of them being put into the camps and the scenes when they were in the assembly centers where it's especially bad conditions. Those are the image that you see when the song is being played.
How was music in America affected by the war and what was happening at the time?
I got a few of the songs from this war, you know, they're war songs that were sung to buoy the spirits of the soldiers and, you know, just get morale of the country up, I think. But one of them was about Pearl Harbor. And so, you know, there were a lot of, you know, over the top. And at the time, there was a lot of racial hysteria going on. And, you know, it creeped in under the guise of patriotism. But really, it was very thinly veiled racism, and there was a lot of other things going on economically that people, you know, there was a faction that felt like, let's get these quote unquote Japs out of here, and so some of those songs were, and some of the graphic, you know, posters and things like that reflected that kind of mindset. So, but then a lot of the songs were the songs that they enjoyed, that everyone enjoyed, who was living at the time, I think, especially young people, and that you know, the Benny Goodman and, you know, all of the swing fun music that was uplifting. And so we used a lot of that, Andrew Sisters. We used Sentimental Journey, and Moonlight Serenade was a real favorite.
Could you talk about the people who became the drive behind the camp bands?
Well, two-thirds of the Japanese who were incarcerated were Japanese-American citizens, were born in the United States. Many of them were young and teenagers, and they loved the popular music of the time. And that was the big band music, swing music, jazz. And so when they got into the camps, they formed these bands. And this chapter in George Yoshida's book was one thing, was so well written, and it just captured my interest. And there was a lot of, I think it was wonderful response to where these people were and what they did with their situation. To quote a very trite phrase, they made lemonade out of lemons. And they loved the music, and they brought it into the camps, and they formed these bands, and it provided a lot of joy and escape for the people who attended the dances, who danced, and especially for those who played in the bands. So that was my, after I read this chapter in his book, I said, I have to do something with this.
What was the positive effect of music in the camps?
One thing, you know, there are some silver linings to every cloud, and I think one of the biggest silver linings that many of our former musicians talk about is that the camps provided them an opportunity to, one, have other Japanese Americans see Japanese Americans perform, be on stage, be leaders, and be, you know, someone that you looked up to, which wouldn't happen so much on the outside. And it gave them a chance to perform when they, you know, they, other than probably performing in their high school band, they wouldn't have the chance to, you know, have all these people dance to their music and get so much enjoyment. Mm-hmm. So, I think that became a wonderful thing, and it was an incredible release for the people who were there.
How did the bands grow or change as the years passed in the camps?
That's a good question. I think some of the bands may not have lasted the full time that the camps were in existence, because a lot of people left, maybe not only to be enlisted or get drafted, but also to go to the Midwest or, you know, to lead the camps. So, and I think that there was turnover too, you know, as younger people got a little older, they might have joined later. So the bands changed in complexion as the years went by.
Could you tell us more about your parents' experience in the Midwest?
They were also teenagers when they were in the camps. They're now in their mid-80s, so they were in their mid-teens when they entered the camps. And my dad's family was living in Seattle, so his family was first, they were moved to Puyallup, the assembly center there, and then they went to Minidoka, where many families from the Northwest, the Japanese American families were moved to that camp. And then my mom's family was down in Los Angeles, so they were moved to, Turlock Assembly Center, and then they went on to Gila River Camp in Arizona. So two separate camps. They both had different experiences. My dad's family was there for 3.5 years. My mom was there for 1.5 years, and then her family, they were all able to get jobs, including herself, and she was just in high school at the time.
Could you explain more about the post-war movement of camp internees?
If you found sponsors, someone to work for, you were, and this is probably after a year of being in the camps, and I think the government realizing that no one was going to sabotage, you know, these people were not planning on working against the government. If you found placement in either the Midwest or the East Coast, then you could leave the camps. So that's what started to happen, and my mother's family was part of that group. I think George Yoshida, who's become a good friend, has quoted or has said that Chicago, after the war, there were 25,000 Japanese Americans, whereas before the war, I don't know what the population was, but I think it was very small. So larger metropolitan cities in the Midwest did see much more of a community of Japanese Americans after the war. There was Chicago and Cleveland and Denver, St. Louis, even Minneapolis, I think. There are just these little pockets where there were different Japanese Americans had settled. So they were both at the University of Chicago, and they met in that community there. And my mother, she left the camps with her parents, who found jobs in Evanston, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And then she said she was riding the bus with her mom, and this woman, this Caucasian woman, just noticed them and said, "Do you want to work in my home?" And what I'm finding out is that there were a group of Japanese young teenagers who came from different camps, and they were hired by different families, and they lived in their homes, and they did different things. They called them schoolgirls and schoolboys, and they cooked for the family, or they took care of their children. And exchange, they got room and board, and then they attended the local high school. So that's what my mom did. I guess she met this woman, and this woman asked my grandmother if my mom would come work for them and live with them. And right there on the spot, she said yes. And so my mom went to live with them at age 16 and a half and took care of their children and cleaned the dishes and went to school. And then on the weekend, she went and lived with her parents. And I think this is sort of an interesting story that goes beyond the camps, and one that I'm exploring now with my current project, where I'm actually interviewing some of her good friends who ended up in Evanston and hearing what their experience was. Because I think that there were a lot of sympathetic people and who knew that this was an unjust thing that happened. And so they were trying to make right. And, you know, in little ways they could help by, you know, hosting a family. And so I was interested in seeing, you know, what the relationship was with the family, if there was any feeling of prejudice, how difficult it was to come out of the camps and go and work in this totally different culture and make food for people in a way that you've never done before, and then go to a high school where you were the only, besides the other schoolgirls and schoolboys, you were the only Japanese Americans there.
Where does the title Searchlight Serenade come from?
Our producer, Claire Reynolds, came up with that title, and it was the best idea of a bunch of bad ideas that I had personally. I came up with about 20, and all of them were actually the first one I thought was pretty good, but no one else liked it.
It's going to be hard to name it.
So the idea was the Moonlight Serenade was a real favorite of that time. And then the Searchlight, that's one thing that was prominent. They had sentries and guard towers, and they had a searchlight that would comb the, you know, would sweep over the grounds, and people were used to seeing that, and so I think combining those two ideas was pretty brilliant on Claire's part.
Much of your artwork depicts scenes of people younger or older looking through windows. Could you talk a little bit more about the theme of peeking through barriers?
Several of the women talked about people peering in, that she could see her mother peering in to see, you know, because they, I guess, felt too shy to actually come in and watch, or maybe it was too crowded, or you know, these barracks were very small and lots of people dancing. They probably were scared to go in there.
Chiki Ishihara White, who had sang during her years spent in the Minidoka War Relocation Center, reminisced of older camp residents looking in on dances and offered an explanation of migration, culture, and intergenerational distance in the new country.
Well, I think that, you know, because they were all
all people of that age, you know, they did not have, they didn't know what love was about, let's put it that way, because they were all their marriages were, even my top, my oldest brother, my two sisters, their marriages were arranged marriages, you know. And they didn't go dancing, or they didn't even hold hands, you know. So, you know, I think to them, I think when they were looking at us through that window, I think they probably thought, oh, isn't that nice? I wish I could have done that. I kind of think that's the way, at least that's the way I like to think about it.
My interview with Chickie was not limited to fond recollections of music's healing ability. She took some time to honor the other experiences of elders in her family, especially her father, as a first generation, or Ise.
And I'll tell you, my father had a terrible experience. He he wanted to visit these Japanese families that lived in Idaho. They were very, very close friends of ours. And he went out on the bus, and he got to Twin Falls. Now, from Twin Falls, he had to transfer a bus to get to Idaho. Three times they kept telling him to wait, and then the bus would get full. And then they say, oh, you'll have to wait for the next bus. They did that to him three times, and he never got to Idaho. He never got to visit his friends. And, in fact, he never saw them again because he died a year after we got back from camp. Anyway, so when he came back to camp, and he never left camp again. He was just so, you know, he just felt like he was treated so badly. And, you know, here's a man who was a good citizen. He was never on welfare, or there was no such thing. But, I mean, he was not dependent on the government for anything, and he worked hard, and you know, and then to be treated like that, as if it was his fault, you know, and it wasn't. And a lot of the elderly people did have experiences like that. It was totally unfair.
He was a first-generation Ise?
Yes, yes.
Your mother, too?
Yes, my mother is Ise also, yes. And he came to this country when he was like 21, and he had never gone back to Japan, and he was 60, he was in his middle 60s when we went to camp, you know, so he had been here, you know, a good part of his life, you know, and so to be treated like that, that's not right, that wasn't right. But there was a lot of things that was not right with evacuation and incarceration, all that sort of thing. And I hope it never happens to anybody else, you know. And it's one of those things that I'm proud to say that the Japanese people did not give the country a lot of problems, and they, as the one fellow said, you know, shikata ga nai, you know, this is it, we're going to make the best of everything, you know, and that's what we did, and I'm proud that we did that.
Amy Uyaki also offered some thoughts about building community in the camps as well.
It's probably, I don't know, culture seems to assimilate people faster than other aspects of our life, and it's something that we go to for sustenance, I think, and for enjoyment, and for community. Really, that's something that you can do that's very positive, and so I think that's a real message of this documentary and the animation is, you know, that, you know, it's a wonderful outlet and a source of understanding, I think, understanding our culture and relationships. I think that's what this whole process taught me, and also the people we talked to, the former musicians, they were so positive, and I think that the music played a big part in that. I mean, when they look back on their experience, that's one of the real shining lights, you know, that they got from it, was that sense of community, too, that they got from being in the bands.
For more information about the documentary Searchlight Serenade, visit the website www.searchlight-serenade.org. Vivek Bald is a scholar from MIT and the author of Bengali Harlem and the Lost Histories of South Asian America. This book details the history of Bengali merchants and maritime workers who settled in New York City and New Orleans during the early 1920s. The common story is that South Asian immigration was halted due to immigration policies at the time. Vivek Bald uncovered these lost histories with help and inspiration from his good friend and spoken word performer, Aladdin Ulla, who performs under the name Aladdin. Ulla's father, who immigrated to New York City in the 1920s, used to tell tales of his own immigration story, unique to all others of the time. Most compelling is that many Bengali immigrants lived and worked in the United States during a time when Asian immigrants were not allowed in the country.
The common wisdom was that in 1917, when the U.S. passed these very restrictive and what we now thankfully understand quite clearly as racist immigration laws, including what was referred to as the Asiatic Barred Zone, that essentially barred almost everyone from Asia from even entering the country. You know, so the idea was that after that act and then after the 1923 Supreme Court decision in the U.S. versus Bhagat Singh Thind, that Indian or South Asian migration had just pretty much come to a halt. And the entry into the country was barred by the 1917 Act, and the avenue to becoming citizens was blocked by the 1923 court case. So the narrative really skipped forward from that point until 1965. But this time, that story had at its center, because of the way that the 65 law was written, professionals, doctors, engineers, etc., the folks who came to be the face of the South Asian community in the decades after that. So Aladdin's father had lived most of his life in the United States in that period between 1917 and 1965, in which supposedly South Asian immigrants weren't even getting into the country. And Aladdin and I started to work on a documentary centering around his father and on, you know, the questions that Aladdin still had about his father and his father's life. His father had a circle of friends in Harlem who were also Bengali, but it wasn't clear whether they were just this tiny group or whether they were part of a larger history. And that question was the question that was central for me going into what became this book. You know, was Aladdin's father and his small group of friends, were they just an anomaly, or were they part of a history that had been completely overlooked? It became clear that instead of this kind of broken immigration history, you know, that started and had a couple of decades in the early 20th century on the West Coast and then stopped and then started again in 1965 with the engineers and doctors, etc., that there has been continuous migration, and quite specifically working class migration from South Asia that goes back to the late 19th century. That includes people from present day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And that in the case of the maritime workers have been not only present continuously in New York City since the early part of the 20th century, but working in specific sectors of the urban economy as dishwashers and line cooks and other kinds of restaurant workers, for example. So that, you know, when we look at New York City today and, you know, people think of the presence of Bangladeshi workers within New York City restaurants, you know, and think of that as a relatively recent phenomena. In fact, there's a history that stretches back 100 years. One of the things that's important there is that even though the wave of migration that came in the wake of 1965 was so large that it kind of rendered invisible other communities and other histories, that it's important to recover these earlier histories to understand that there's a continuous presence of working class immigrants from South Asia in cities like New York. One thing that's important to emphasize, I think, is that it is really the role of the neighborhoods and the communities where these South Asian Muslim immigrants were settling, in the sense that this was a time, as you've mentioned, that in which, you know, for the earlier groups, the immigration laws were kind of closing in on them. For the later groups after 1965, they were living in the shadows of the immigration laws. So it was a time at which in which the nation itself was only criminalizing and rejecting and seeking to keep out this group of immigrants. But at the same time, African-American and Puerto Rican communities provided those men with the possibilities to build lives and provided shelter and, in a sense, lived up to the promise that the nation did not live up to, but lived up to that promise not as representatives of the nation, but as other groups marginalized by the nation, other groups denied full purchase and full citizenship.
Bengali Harlem profiles a few lesser-known characters who served as leaders in the communities and whose impact is seen to this day. The first is Dada Amir Khan and his involvement in the revolutionary Ghadar Party.
And I started reading through Dada Khan's memoir, and it was just quite amazing because it was the first time, and it possibly is the only first-hand account of a South Asian steamship worker in the U.S. in the early part of the 20th century. Dada Khan joined the maritime trade. He was originally from Kashmir on what's now the Pakistan side, joined the Merchant Marine as a 14-year-old out of Bombay. By the time he was about 18, in 1918, he jumped ship in New York City. And he spent the next 7 years in and out of the United States with working on American ships with New York as his home port, and got involved in expatriate nationalism, working in alignment with the Ghadar Party, you know, using the maritime trade to smuggle pamphlets and leaflets and stuff from the United States, from the Ghadar Party and the Friends of Freedom for India in the United States back to the subcontinent and everywhere in between where there were South Asians. And also at a certain point left the American maritime trade because of the racism that he was facing within the American Merchant Marine, and made his way to Detroit. Dada Khan was just really radicalized even further by living within the African-American community in Black Bottom, Detroit, you know, watching that community mobilize around a particular case. So Dada Khan's story, his 7 years in the United States, are just this really incredible arc. It's a window into the world of sailors and ex-sailors in the United States at that time that would not be accessible in any other way. That was, you know, that confirmed a lot of things that I had found in archival documents, but of course had a richness that those archival documents didn't have through Dada Khan's own voice and narrative.
Another leader in the community is the story of Ibrahim Chowdhury, whose impact was seen in both the Bengali and African-American communities.
Ibrahim Chowdhury is a figure who is important at a slightly later time in terms of the formation of a Bengali community in New York City. He came to the U.S. in the early 20s, or sometime in the 1920s, after being on the run from British authorities because he had been involved as a student in India. During the Second World War, he appears to have convinced the British consulate or the British government to open a merchant sailors club specifically for Indian seamen in New York City. And this is something that the British government was doing across the globe, but the Indian seamen, who were a good percentage of the maritime workforce on British ships, were not necessarily comfortable with those spaces. And so Ibrahim Chowdhury appears to have convinced the British government to open a maritime club specifically for Indians. It quickly became the biggest of its kind, really. Thousands of men, South Asian men specifically, going in and out of this club on 38th Street and 6th Avenue in New York City. And Ibrahim Chowdhury was kind of at the center of it, finding these men as they came in on ships, bringing them to the club and writing letters for non-literate seamen so that they could send messages back to their families, and organizing games and trips. And there was a kitchen that served meals there, etc. So this was the beginning of what was many years of Ibrahim Chowdhury playing that kind of a community role in New York City. So he was also, in 1947, one of the founders of an organization called the Pakistan League of America, from what I can tell, predominantly made up of Bengali Muslim men who were from what was then East Pakistan and what would become Bangladesh. The Pakistan League functioned for, you know, a couple of decades, sponsored yearly Eid celebrations that brought together all of these families that were mixed South Asian Muslim men with African-American and Puerto Rican and other women. And all of their mixed children would get together to celebrate Eid every year. Ultimately, Ibrahim Chowdhury also started building ties with African-American Muslim organizations in Harlem and elsewhere, and also was involved in a number of interfaith initiatives all the way back in the 1950s. So he's a really important figure and kind of unknown figure who was really at the center of the consolidation of a predominantly Bengali Muslim community in New York City going back to the 1940s. In congressional testimony, I found a letter that Ibrahim Chowdhury had written as part of an effort that a number of different Indian organizations were involved in to try to change the immigration and naturalization laws and to open up a quota for migrants from India to naturalize. So this was an early lobbying effort that did result in some changes to the laws in 1946. And Ibrahim Chowdhury wrote a really passionate letter. You know, there were other people lobbying as part of this lobbying effort in the 40s who were making that kind of argument. And Ibrahim Chowdhury sent in this letter that really passionately talked about the farmers and workers, how they had actually been contributing to the United States as industrial workers and as agricultural workers for several decades, and that they had given their best lives and were still unable to become citizens. So that was quite amazing to find that particular document, and to find that, you know, became the core of the argument for the 1965 Act, which favored professionals and et cetera, that amidst all of these early voices putting forward that argument that Ibrahim Chowdhury was in fact making an argument for the farmers and the workers who were there already.
That was Vivek Bald, author of Bengali Harlem and the Lost Histories of South Asian Americans. There are many more stories we couldn't include in this broadcast. To learn more about the project, including the online archive, his upcoming documentary, and performer Aladdin Ullah, check out the website BengaliHarlem.com. I'm Sari Gametha, and you're listening to APA Compass.
You are here with Ka on APA Compass from Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest only Asian Pacific American Public Affairs Radio Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, this is Ka on Heart to Heart. My voice through the airwaves really allow me to open up, express, and want to explore. So for this month of October on my Heart to Heart, I want to share with you my leadership experiences. I was selected to join a leadership institution in 2012. The Asian Pacific Islander Community Leadership Institution, also known as the PICLI, was founded in 2011 by a partnership project between ARCO, Asian Family Center, and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO. It is one of the six culturally specific leadership programs funded by the Mayor's Memorials Trust through the Coalition of Communities of Color. I myself joined with 22 other amazing APIs from all over Oregon, the leadership program designed at a 7-month training. APICLE is with the vision of building leadership capacity and building collaborative alliances and partnerships among Asian Pacific Islander communities. Now, I had the opportunity to respond and be engaged in many topics, and some were racial and ethnic inequalities faced by communities of colors here in Oregon, the context of culture, immigrants, and refugees. Then I learned to expand the pathways for social inclusion, increase the civic engagement, and networking in the communities of colors. All the leadership skills that I've built circulate to engage and empower each other. I also had the option to work in team-based in my expertise to design and facilitate workshops. My fellows and I, who also worked on community action projects with other partners organizations to address issues and concerns that impacted our API communities. Now, during the Asian Pacific Islander Community Leadership Institution, my action project was focused on filmmaking. Now, during my leadership training and at the very same time volunteering for APANO as a civic engagement associate, I focused my thoughts around voting rights, and I came up with the idea of Get Out the Vote video. Now, the Get Out the Vote video is to encourage APIs to exercise their rights to vote by sharing the different API languages and bilingual terms on the word vote. SV Villalai and Kevin Hu, my two partners in crime, and all my other fellows helped GOTV came alive. The filming process took about 3 months to complete. The film illuminated how languages access help to shape a truer democracy for all Americans. So by the end of my one-year training, I graduated from the leadership institution and I found my purpose. I wanted to provide media access to APA communities. My passion and my leadership skills have blossomed. I became an active volunteer for APA Compass with my segment On Air with Ka, Heart to Heart. As a community host, I will provide vibrant sources in promoting greater awareness and understanding of Asian and Pacific Islander American cultures. So what is a community leader? A leader to me is the greatest leaders come from all walks of life. Leaders and revolutionaries are liberal icons. A warrior for the less fortunate, a champion of builders and titans, and a fierce advocate for all. Heroes and icons have the ability to express themselves powerfully to share strength with tremendous compassion and empathy. The role of a community leader devotes the intense caring to serve people in need and fight on behalf of their causes. A leader embodies the vibrancy and confidence in gender balance and believes in woman and child eyes view. A community leader benefits from their personal stories that demonstrate their experience and advice. A community leader is someone who has friendship he and she can give to a stranger. They are a great listener. They are kind and loyal. Their skills is always moving forward, seeking and changing, like the great explorer who resets her horizon every time they sailed. Now, although not everyone can be a leader, everyone knows of a great leader. So this concludes my Heart to Heart for this month. And moving on, I would like to share some community events for October. So please come out and join us. For this Saturday, October 5th, we have from the Asian Pacific American Chambers of Commerce from noon until 3 p.m. It is free potluck. Come join Families of APAC in the license program to celebrate community gatherings and ethnic food and refreshments. It'll be happening at the Mekong Bistro in Portland. Also happening the same day on Saturday, October 5th, from 5 p.m. at the Helium Comedy Club. The Disoriented Comedy Tour is visiting Portland. Disoriented is an all-female APA comedy group founded by Jenny Yang and Atsuko Okatsuka. Fundraise will go towards the Asian American Woman at the South Asian Woman Empowerment and Resource Alliance and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Then later this month, the Asian Pacific American Chambers of Commerce presenting the first signature event, 2013 AAPI Appreciation Award Banquet, Friday, October 11th, starting at 5 p.m. at the Pavilion at the Portland Hilton Hotel. The AAPI Appreciation Award recognized the efforts of individuals, businesses, organizations, and government agencies that have made outstanding contributions to the Asian American Pacific Islander communities in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And then lastly, we have Clara C., a Korean-American, a YouTube and an independent artist. With her 2013 acoustic concert tour, she'll be in Portland on October 26th at the Backspace starting at 8 p.m.
You've been listening to APA Compass. We want to say a special thank you to our guests, Roy Matsumoto, Shig Imai, Chiki Ishihara-White, Amy Ueki, and Vivek Bald. Today's program was produced by Kahir, Sarika Mehta, Anna Preble, and Andrew Ye. Tune in to APA Compass on the first Friday of every month at 9 a.m. here on KBOO Community Radio. If you have questions, comments, or ideas, you can connect with us through our Facebook account. Podcasts